Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Yeah! Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, and isn't it funny when the continuous hypocrisy of the right wing is exposed time and time again? This week, it's Florida's Mike Rogers. Yes, Florida Mike Rogers is running for Michigan's vacant U.S. Senate seat for the Republican Party. And in case you didn't remember, Florida's Mike Rogers moved back into Michigan after being away for a few years to make a little dough as a defense lobbyist. I mean, Florida Mike needed to really take advantage of that revolving door between Congress and the lobbyist while, you know, he was still a name, right? He had to get it while the getting was good. Well, Florida Mike also scored Dear Leader's endorsement last month, if you forgot, and he thanked Dear Leader by saying, "Thank you, Mr. President, thank you. Excited to get to work with you to get America and Michigan back on track." Okay, how's Mike going to get Michigan back on track, which is already finally beginning to get back on track after 40 years of Republican failure? What's Mike going to do? And why is Florida Mike Rogers so enthusiastic about joining forces with someone found liable for sexual abuse? I don't get it. I mean, where are the family values that you've always espoused, Florida Mike? Or are you trying to tell me that was all show? I mean, how the hell would he know what Michiganders need? Hell, when he was recently on Off the Record, he didn't even know what the Prop 3 ballot initiative in 2022 was all about. Listen.
How did you vote on
Prop 3?
Prop 3,
the abortion issue.
Listen, I think that here's what's going to happen in abortion in America.
How did you vote on it?
Here's, there's a curtain behind there for a reason. Oh, come on, that's funny.
I was just curious if you even voted, though, in Michigan.
I did not vote in Michigan.
Okay.
I had moved to Florida because of some business opportunities. Sure. I had down there.
Yeah, Florida's Mike Rogers really has his ear to the ground when it comes to Michiganders' needs, doesn't he? I mean, it's such a joke because we learned this week, thanks in part to Democratic Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin's campaign, she's also running for the Senate seat as well, Florida's Mike Rogers is registered still to vote in his home state of Florida. Not only that, but according to Michigan Advance's John King from a few months ago, Florida's Mike Rogers still owns a large home in Florida. The 4,751-square-foot home in Cape Coral is valued at $1.7 million, and it was his official residence until his decision to run for the U.S. Senate seat. Now, Florida's Mike is currently living with his sister in Brighton, according to Newsweek, and he also owns a home somewhere in Oakland County. I mean, a guy with this many homes is probably one who's got his finger on the pulse of Michigan, wouldn't you say? Oh, man. And as for being registered to vote in two states, Florida Mike's campaign says he's a registered voter in Michigan and his name just hasn't been purged yet in Florida. Yes, yes, yes. I'm certain that is the case. And I'm being fair on that point. I am, really. I'm being not sarcastic, all right? But how many Republicans have claimed through the years that there's rampant voter fraud because of people still being registered in two states, even though they vote in just one state? How many? We've heard it over and over again. So by the right-wing Republican standard, Florida's Mike Rogers is guilty. Guilty, I say, of voter fraud. Such hypocrites. But there he was, voting in Florida a few years ago, and now he says he can fly back up to Michigan and become the senator of the state that he left. And one more thing, Alternet did some digging on Florida Mike's Cape Coral house. Now, if you recall, Cape Coral suffered a direct hit by Hurricane Ian a couple of years ago. And here's what Alternet wrote about its research over the kind of damage and compensation that Florida's Mike might have received from the federal government and why that's important. And I quote, The National Flood Insurance Program, which is the federal program that underwrites all flood insurance claims in the U.S., pays replacement cash value, or RCV, in claims where the affected property is the insured's principal residence. In cases where a home is a secondary residence, the NFIP instead pays actual cash value, or ACV, which is a lesser amount. If Mike Rogers qualified for an RCV claim, that would mean he told the federal government that the Cape Coral house was his principal residence at the time of the flood. The Rogers campaign has still not responded to Alternet's email inquiry asking if his Cape Coral home was damaged by Hurricane Ian, and if it was, if the adjuster assigned to his claim recommended an ACV or RCV payment. Ooh, this could get very, very sticky for Florida's Mike. We'll keep you posted. However, I can't blame him for moving back to Michigan because thanks to Governor Gretchen Whitmer and the Democratic majority in Lansing, freedom rings true here while Florida slides further and further down a wretched white Christian nationalist nightmare. But you know what isn't funny? Is the war on health and economic freedoms of women across the country when it comes to abortion rights. And I'll address that more in this week's Last Call segment later on. Again, I know many of the so-called very serious people in Lansing and across the country want everyone believing that abortion and contraception rights will not be a major issue this coming November, but it could be the issue that decides this election year. So stay tuned. I'll have more to say on it in this episode. I just wanted to say a quick congratulations to Democratic State Representative Betsy Cafia from Traverse City. I had Representative Cafia on last year, and we talked about a bill that she pushed for that allows 16 to 17 and a half year old Michiganders to pre-register to vote. And that bill passed, and Michigan joined Minnesota and Illinois as just the third state to allow 16 and 17 and a half year olds to pre-register to vote. That's amazing that we don't try to make pre-registration just easier for young adults. It doesn't make any sense to me. But the main reason Representative Cafia made this a priority is because she wanted to get more young people engaged in our political process. And the more that get engaged, the more voices will be heard, which is something many elites throughout the country, and especially here in our state, definitely do not want, believe me. Now, while on Left of Lansing last year, Representative Cafia explained why she believed in the ultimate goal of this bill. Listen.
The stats show that anywhere from 2 to 14% increase in voter participation when you have 16-year-old pre-registration. So this will just increase young people engaging in the political process. Jocelyn Benson, I'm proud to say, you know, after I put my bill forward and she's texted me a news article and said this is one of the most important pieces of voting rights legislation to get passed for ahead of 2024. So with somebody I respect a lot in the Secretary of State thinking this is really important, I'm excited to get it done through the Senate.
So now all 16 and 17-year-olds can pre-register by going online with a Michigan driver's license or state ID, or they can just go to their local city clerk. Then they'll be ready to vote when they turn 18. I mean, this kind of bill will increase voter participation among young Michiganders, which is exactly why Republicans blocked similar efforts when they were in the majority. Well, Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed Representative Cafia's bill into law, and this week 16 and 17 and a half year old Michiganders can now pre-register to vote. No, they won't be allowed to vote, right-wingers, all right? So put away your little paranoid conspiracies. They cannot vote until they're 18, but they can pre-register now so that they won't have to worry about it when they turn 18 while they're busy getting ready to go off to college, getting ready to go to trade school, or having to deal with whatever life throws at them at 18 years old. I mean, come on. We remember what it's like then. Lots of things are happening at that moment in your life. So this is about increasing the voting pool and getting more young people engaged in our process, a process that right-wingers want to make more and more difficult. The fewer the voters, the better, they say. Well, we progressives don't believe that. We progressives believe in something called democracy, and getting more participation will only benefit all of us in the future. Visit MichiganVotes.org for additional info, by the way. And well done, Representative Betsy Cafia and all Democrats. And well done by Michigan progressives out there for helping expand voting rights, which helps make voting easier in the state. Voting shouldn't be difficult, and that's why it was awesome when Governor Whitmer signed a slew of voting bills into law, including allowing people to vote with either a photo ID or a signed affidavit. We also have expanded ballot drop boxes and the number of days that people can vote. It's just common sense. I mean, this grants people more access to the polls, more access to our democracy, and more access to our government. The opposite of what the right-wing Republican Party has done for years. Now, before I move on to this week's interview, which I'll talk about here in a second, veteran Lansing political reporter John Lindstrom wrote a piece in the Detroit Free Press on Governor Whitmer's presidential aspirations in 2028. Of course, we still have a major election to get through here in 7 months. Nobody's forgetting that. So Lindstrom says the 24 election is vital for Whitmer if she hopes to become a real contender in 2028. And he writes, and I quote, "Right now, Whitmer's popularity may be her biggest advantage, but some Democrats complain she isn't using it to the party's best interests and her own. Some Democrats believe Whitmer should be working more actively with the party in the 2024 election. And to be a factor in 2028, she has to deliver big prizes in 2024. So Linderman says Whitmer must deliver Michigan to Joe Biden this fall, and she has to use her popularity on helping Democrats keep the seat that Senator Debbie Stabenow is leaving, and she also has to play a key role at helping House Democrats retain their seats, as well as help Democrats oust Republican Congressman John James in Sterling Heights. And I agree with Linderman completely, but it doesn't just end there. No, it doesn't just end with the national races, as important as they most certainly are. Governor Whitmer must, and I mean must, be a force in helping Democrats retain the state house. If Democrats keep the state house, hey, that would serve as a win-win for Whitmer. She'd be able to continue plugging along, signing more common sense progressive policies, popular policies, by the way, demonstrating to the state and the country how her policies are about helping people. However, if Democrats lose the state house, her agenda and the progressive agenda is stymied for the next 2 years by the radical right-wing Republican Party, and which will block any chance of her passing anything meaningful in the final 2 years of her administration. So keeping the state legislature blue is vital, but not just for Whitmer's presidential aspirations, but for the entire state. I mean, we saw one example this week where passing some bold policies will help people in the future. We saw James and Jennifer Crumley, who are the parents of the Oxford High School shooter. We saw how they were each sentenced to 10 to 15 years in prison for their roles in that tragedy. James Crumley bought his son a gun, the same gun his son would use to kill four classmates 4 days later. Now, a couple of months ago, a new gun safety law went into effect here in the state in which gun owners are now criminally liable. I'm going to repeat that. Criminally liable. If they fail to keep their guns locked away from kids who might harm themselves or others. So while this law happened after the tragedy in Oxford, Michigan Democrats passed a law designed to punish parents in the future and to punish others who fail to lock away their guns from kids. This is a public health issue because it's a public health crisis. And that crisis was addressed by Democrats. Republicans in Lansing didn't want to lift a finger whatsoever, and they would have fought for parents like the Crumleys from facing any kind of punishment. Think about that. Think about that. That's just one of the many reasons why keeping the state house blue is so vital in November. And if Gretchen Whitmer wants to solidify the gains that we've made here in the state, she'll fight hard for state house Democrats, which in turn helps her in 2028. If she runs, and, you know, I hope she does. But all that being said, we need Democrats to keep the legislature because I get the sense that they, especially progressive Democrats, are done with doing things how they used to be done and are now leading a charge to change an old mindset that's hurt the state for far, far too long. I had Lou Glaser, president of Michigan Future Incorporated, on the show a few weeks ago, and he lamented how Lansing lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have been mired in this 1979 mindset that we must spend, spend, spend on keeping Michigan a manufacturing state. And by spending, I'm talking about spending millions upon millions upon millions of dollars on corporate subsidies. You see, many lawmakers for years have believed that this is the best way to attract businesses and people to the state. In 2021, after Ford announced its plans to build EV car battery plants in Kentucky and Tennessee, Republicans and Democrats in Lansing quickly joined forces to pass bills to set up a $1 billion fund to attract large projects designed to create thousands of jobs, so they said. But rather than spend that money on growing the talent base here in Michigan and building an infrastructure for the future, many of our lawmakers lost their collective minds and thought that we had to quickly sign a bill so that way we could hand out loads of cash to big corporations and that they said that would solve everything. And Senate Democrats a few weeks ago passed a business incentive reform package that requires half of all subsidies, or incentives, as they like to call them in Lansing, to be spent on local housing, childcare, education, and transit projects where these corporations will reside. Thank you. About time. And it's a good thing that Senate Democrats passed these bills, which will now move on to the House, because the current system of just handing out cash to corporations isn't giving us the best results whatsoever. Also, it's a smart way for legislative Democrats to hold Governor Whitmer accountable on some of these large-scale projects, which haven't exactly done what they're promised. And it's perhaps one of the few areas where I have disagreed with the governor. But that doesn't mean she's alone on this. Republicans who controlled the legislature when this $1 billion SOAR fund was created, they were all on board. Of course, now they're against it. They were for it before they were against it. Anyway, Paula Gardner is the business editor at Bridge Michigan, and she's written some insightful investigative pieces on Michigan's corporate subsidies program and how they're not really achieving all the goals that they promised. Stunning, stunning, I know. She's my guest this week and will join me here right after this quick break. Also, let me say a quick thank you to my good friend Rich for all of his hard work with the website. Please visit leftoflansing.com.
Listening to Left of Lansing. If the podcast isn't enough and you are in need of more Pat, follow him on Twitter and like him on Facebook. Also, don't forget you can read more of his thoughts and hear an archive of past episodes on leftoflansing.com.
Stay tuned for the Left of Lansing, a weekly online poll coming up after my interview here. And of course, you can always email me, leftoflansing@gmail.com, whenever you'd like. Okay, if you've listened to this podcast since it started a few years ago, you know that I've stayed, for the most part, consistent when it comes to corporate subsidies. In fact, I think it's one of the few areas that a progressive like me can find common ground with people from the right wing, like the Mackinac Center think tank, for instance. Now, of course, there are some nuances when it comes to subsidies for corporations and companies, as I've discussed when it comes to the new film incentives, for instance, or even the Goshen Battery Plant in Mecosta County. But for the most part, I'd like to ask, are corporate subsidies really the best way to not only create good-paying jobs, but also to bring in and expand the talent base here in the state? Well, last month, Bridge Michigan unveiled an extensive report on whether or not the corporate subsidies that we've shelled out here in Michigan are doing what they promised, and it turns out, they really aren't. Paula Gardner is the business editor at Bridge Michigan, and she wrote an important piece many of you should check out titled, Corporate Subsidies Cost Michigan $335 Million, 40% of deals create low-paying jobs. I'll provide a link to that piece on this week's episode page located at leftoflansing.com. But joining me now to talk about it is Paula Gardner, and I'm ecstatic to have her here on this week's podcast. So Paula, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, I appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
Well, before we talk about corporate subsidies, since I have you here, if you don't mind, would you mind just letting our listeners know what Bridge Michigan is all about and why it is such, you know, I like to think of it as an important asset to all those who want to know what's happening in Lansing and across the state?
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah. Bridge Michigan has been around for more than a decade now. We were started as a nonprofit, nonpartisan journalism kind of offshoot of a think tank. And we continue as journalists. Most of us are trained. We've been in Michigan for a very long time, or very, very long time, as the case may be. And we look for neutral reporting when that's absolutely warranted, or accountability reporting, which kind of delves into, you know, what went wrong, but also offers solutions to what could be right about it.
How long have you been with Bridge Michigan?
Oh, I just celebrated my fourth anniversary. I started during the pandemic. I had been working on a projects team at MLive doing a lot of environmental coverage, but I also have covered business on and off for many, many years. And I've also been an editor in Michigan at MLive and at the Free Press and at the Ann Arbor News.
lots of experience here dealing with the state of Michigan and the news area. And I just want to make sure I forgot to say your title in my intro. You are the business editor at Bridge Michigan, correct?
Yes.
All right. Well, let's get into this piece that you wrote last month on corporate subsidies in Michigan. So first off, what made you want to look into this whole area of corporate subsidies and whether or not they were providing good paying jobs, as not only Governor Whitmer promised, but many on both sides of the aisle had promised?
I cover the Michigan Economic Development Corporation every month when they make their awards. You know, oftentimes it's job awards or job incentive awards. Sometimes it's community improvements. Sometimes it's different types of things. But I do take a look at the agendas every time, the board packets, weigh every decision that the Michigan Strategic Fund ends up making that I consider newsworthy for statewide readers. And over many years, I've watched Michigan say that we're getting good paying jobs from all of that spending. And the more I looked at things, the less I saw that actually quantified it. And I think there are a few things recently that just raised questions about it. And I would say the Ford Marshall deal for the battery plant, when we all learned that many of the workers there, despite about $2 billion in subsidies, were going to be making about $40,000 possibly. And, you know, it just kind of gelled for me that hearing over and over again that we're creating good paying jobs through these measures, but without having that quantified, when transparency and details are such a tenet of this administration and what the state's agencies and departments say they do. I just wanted to know a little bit more. I actually started this as a fairly straightforward, I thought it was going to be a very straightforward spreadsheet. You know, here I go, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, here's a story. And a few months later, you saw what it led to.
Yeah, very, very in-depth article there. And in that investigation, and as I stated already, and it's in the title of it, it says that you found 40% of the deals that came from the $335 million in subsidy money are going to, quote, low-paying jobs. Could you define for me and others that are listening what defines a low-paying job, I guess, when it comes to these subsidies?
You know, even the term low paying has some value judgment to it. We had a lot of discussions about what numbers even to use. What is reported to the state and then in turn by the state is the expected average pay. So when a company gets a state incentive, there's a number attached to it that usually ends up in a board packet, but doesn't always. And I had to request, I don't know, four dozen of them especially. But there's this expected average pay. And average, of course, comes with all sorts of issues attached to it. Some of these jobs involve CEOs, a lot of like high-level C-suite type positions, and then a lot of production jobs. So you really have no idea from that average what real people are going to end up making. We had to accept that as that was the number that we had. So we took that average and looked then at the state median base wage, which is about $45,000. And we figured that was the best number to compare it to because it was the middle and it was the base wage. So this isn't bonuses. This isn't overtime. This is what people are actually expect to make when they go to work every day. And low paying ended up being the ones that fall under that measure. We also, though, because the state applies regional numbers to that too, they're looking at the regional wage as a justification. So we broke every award down into what the regional wage was, which in many cases would have been lower, not all cases. Wayne County, for example, has a higher median wage regionally than the state. But for the purposes of overall analysis, because we're talking, you know, state money, statewide everything, we kept the state number as the metric. Many of the jobs also, though, didn't make the regional baseline that the state set for itself. You know, they kind of talked around it and said they're pathway jobs, you know, they're going to lead to something better, they're going to get raises in a year or two or whatever. So like they even bent their own rules.
And I saw that. I'm glad you brought that up because I saw how you wrote that the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, that they argue that while these jobs may be on average, like you just said, I mean, may be lower than the state average, many of these jobs are better than the regional averages, maybe, where these companies are setting up shop. But regardless, it doesn't seem like that's exactly how this was all advertised, right?
Right. What I'm hoping that readers gain from some of this is that we are calling, and I say we, but like, you know, the state, if the state says these are not low-paying jobs, I mean, if the median is the barometer, you know, like we need to decide as citizens here, is that the best barometer for low-paying or high-paying? Because we already know that Michigan has lost ground in wages anyway. So if we're just looking at what we make on average here and then say that's a good paying job to meet that or slightly exceed it, we have to make a decision whether that's actually warranted or true or how we choose to interpret what a good paying job is.
Right, because what was the number, like the per capita income in Michigan? It has dropped to what, 39th in the nation? Is there somewhere around there, right?
Basically, we're heading towards Mississippi. As I wrote a story, you know, a while back, two more states are probably going to pass us. We'll be in the bottom quintile, probably by the end of this year.
You know, the UAW landed some major victories in their showdown with the big three automakers. And, you know, we saw those victories filtering over to non-union auto companies who started promising wage hikes for their workers. Will that change? I mean, obviously, you couldn't take that all into account right now. I know that. But just with your experience and knowledge into this whole thing, do you think that will change the average pay scale in the state a little bit in the future? Or we just don't know?
I would say that we just don't know.
Okay.
Those UAW jobs are fewer. The automakers are going to be trying to use automation to employ less in the future. I think all of that will change how it filters into like statewide numbers for overall wages and also for manufacturing wages. And also the parts suppliers are a big part of Michigan, and they operate on kind of a different plane. And I think that's where I'm seeing a lot of the lower wages. And I'm not sure that's going to change. Unless they can't find employees, you know, which is the classic way to raise wages, you know, scarcity.
Right. Which we sort of saw happening right after the pandemic, right? In a way.
Right.
Yeah. So, Paula, who is receiving the brunt of all these corporate incentives that we've been handing out here for the past couple of years?
Most of them are manufacturers. Mm. Michigan has, I believe it's 9 industries that they're targeting for wage and job growth. And that's what the MEDC is looking for, what it says it's looking for when it makes these awards. But still, the bulk of the jobs are manufacturing. Some of them go into food. Some of them go into pharma. But a lot of them are still auto related.
So it seems like we are still kind of like in this mindset that in order to grow things, everything has to be in manufacturing rather than expanding the state's portfolio, economic portfolio.
Yeah, that's another thing. You know, that was my value judgment to make in all of this. I categorized things by manufacturing, technology, or other, which is kind of like the catch-all bucket. You know, there were some question marks, you know, would it go in either one? So I either made my best decision or put it into other without calling it manufacturing or technology. And there were a number of technology type jobs that paid quite a bit that Michigan was successful in attracting and giving these incentives to. But the bulk truly was manufacturing. And I think that raises questions about the companies that want to be in the state still and how successful the state is at diversifying. When I first started this, I was kind of thinking along the lines of these are the companies Michigan is rewarding with incentives. And by the time I was done, I kind of felt a little concerned and started to think these are the companies that want to be in Michigan. And maybe it's the best that the state can get.
If you don't mind, can we just backtrack for a brief moment and have you discuss why Lansing suddenly decided that this influx of tax money was immediately needed in order to supply these corporate subsidies? Because I think it all started, like you wrote in your article, a few years ago when Ford announced that it was building that electric vehicle or those electric vehicle battery plants in both Tennessee and Kentucky, right?
In Michigan, incentives took off a couple of years ago as the state recognized that it, as much as it celebrated and tried to be a player in the changes in the automotive industry, that one of its hometown heroes, Ford Motor Company, was choosing Tennessee and Kentucky for its largest investment ever and 2 EV properties, one in each state, totaling, you know, something like $11 billion. So that loss stung. It drove many, many people to consider what we needed in Michigan in order to be a bit more attractive to companies that were seeking EV-related sites. There was a lot of federal money floating around. There still is. But at that time, the heat for corporate decision-making regarding EVs and siting, you know, factories and all sorts of things was just like very, very intense. And Michigan responded by creating the SOAR Fund. And so there were suddenly, over a couple of years, billions of dollars available to try to attract companies. And I use the word attract because that's the state word, but you know, whatever your word you want to use there, but to incentivize companies to make a decision that Michigan would be the place for expansion. and to establish businesses. So the EV-driven growth was enormous, and so was the subsidy at that point. Every deal got bigger. You know, we're seeing mega sites now, Goshen near Big Rapids, Marshall, where Ford is actually coming out of the ground now. I was surprised recently to drive by and see factory pieces starting to appear on the farmland horizon. General Motors, of course, was the first one. So some of these deals, just the stakes became immediately higher.
Yeah. You know, I went back and I read your interview that you did with former Republican Senator Ken Horn from Frankenmuth as he was spearheading this fast tracking, I guess you could call it, of corporate subsidy money, since Republicans were still in the majority in the state legislature back in 21. But, you know, this was a bipartisan effort, but there were some on the right and some progressives who voted against it, yet it prevailed. But Ken Horn told you in that interview that had Ford decided to build those plants in Michigan rather than Tennessee and Kentucky, we would have recovered that investment in less than 10 years if we had given them the same kinds of subsidies. But according to your analysis, Paula, that's not exactly the case, right?
It is so complicated to determine a rate of return on these subsidy deals. I often talk to Tim Bartik at the Upjohn Institute for a little bit of help deciphering that. I think anybody who's looking at a conclusion needs to have a little bit of skepticism about it. Tim often talks about the but-for kind of situation there. Like, did we have to give them the money, or would they be here but for that or not?
Yeah.
How much are they spending? And there's all sorts of hidden subsidy too, which I expect to explore a bit more this year. The state gives up a lot in job training. The state gives up a lot in road repairs and also time of experts who are basically assigned to see projects through. So the actual cost is tough. It's a tough one.
So is it maybe the actual cost is even more?
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah.
Is it your belief that many lawmakers, and forgive me for not coming up, I guess, with a better phrase here, but did many lawmakers back in 21 simply just freak out after what happened with Ford and, you know, building those plants down south? And this is why they thought this was the only way to save Michigan economically?
Honestly, I think the term freak out is probably pretty good. I stood on a porch on Mackinac Island at the Grand Hotel when a Ford exec stood next to the governor and they announced something. And I don't even remember what it was. It might have been EV charging stations going up Lake Michigan, or, you know, it was something that was kind of nice, you know, something pretty cool. And it was within days that they announced Kentucky and Tennessee. And I cannot believe that anybody in Lansing truly, truly knew what was going on based on what I saw a few days earlier. So I do think freakout is accurate. I think we saw an amazing moment of coalescence from Republicans and Democrats to get the SOAR all set. I haven't seen Lansing act that quickly, especially at that time when there was so much heat around COVID also and a lot of divide there. I mean, frankly, kind of amazing that they got it done. And probably not an accident that General Motors was the first announcement, because it was probably in the pipeline and they were probably fighting for it at that time.
Yeah, exactly. Was it any surprise to you and others in, you know, the cover everything that's happening in Lansing, especially, you know, on the business side here, that Senate Democrats passed the bill last month revising, or, you know, I guess you could call it reforming, the state's business subsidy program?
It's been interesting to watch the Senate Democrats. Many of them had some, I think, in my opinion, I see them as fairly sharp ideas because they're different and they kind of call out a different path to the same end, which is different too. You know, I mean, that's so things like recognizing that if the state is investing or spending, again, a better word, incentive dollars, that instead of giving it to the company, that if it spends it in a different way, the company will benefit, but the community will benefit, and trying to come up with some parameters for how to make that happen. And so that's what they were pursuing. And at the same time, the higher legislation came up too, where there was a return to good jobs for Michigan, where companies could keep what they normally would pay in payroll taxes, but they would get to keep it if they met certain criteria. And that's where I think, like, one of the few places that I've seen true admitted attention to wage growth. You know, these companies who get to do this also have to show for paying people more of the median, well over the median. And I cannot get anybody to say it's because we need to pay people more, it's because we need higher income here. Nobody will say that, but it's clearly the intent from how they're trying to structure it. So there is some intent towards reform, but also to obtain some business growth here. It's not something that's just kind of pulled out of nowhere and punitive to business or, you know, whatever. And I know there's a lot of negotiation around it. And I also think the governor's been fairly silent on it. And I think that probably shows some divide among Democrats.
just my last question. What is the likelihood that Michigan will join other states? Because I know Michigan is one of the few. You wrote about it in requiring a payroll incentive for new job creation by maybe the end of the year or sometime in the near future. Do you think there's a likelihood for that?
I'm not sure I'm going to say likelihood. I think everybody agrees it's a decent measure. But for some reason, things aren't really heading to votes at the pace I would have expected. So I'm not sure. But I do hear very few complaints about that one.
Well, Paula Gardner is the business editor at Bridge Michigan. Thanks so much for providing some extra insight in how and where corporate subsidies are falling short. And I'd love to talk with you so much more about this. I had more questions to ask, which is why I'd really like to have you back on here in the future, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. Thank you.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com.
Again, I'll provide links to some of the stories that Paula Gardner wrote on Bridge Michigan located on the episode page on leftoflansing.com, which leads me to asking you to vote on this week's Left of Lansing online poll located on X, formerly Twitter, at Left of Lansing. The question this week is, do you believe corporate subsidies are the best way to attract businesses and people to Michigan? Do you believe that corporate subsidies are the best way to attract businesses and people to Michigan? Your answers are yes, no, I'm not sure. Time now for the Left of Lansing last call. Well, I said in the beginning of the show that no matter how hard the Lansing media intelligentsia keeps wishing this not to be the case, abortion will be one of the top issues in this fall's election. Yes, we enshrined abortion rights in our state's constitution in 2022. And yes, Democrats erased that 1931 zombie law, which outlawed abortion, just in case Republicans return to political power anytime soon. And as we see, it wasn't a frivolous move by Lansing Democrats to nullify that old law after Arizona's state Supreme Court ruled this week that an 1864 law, which made all abortions illegal, was indeed constitutional in that state. And the right wing, well, you know, celebrated. Some are realizing the repercussions that are going to follow, but still, they celebrated. This is what they want in the end. And that's why you're hearing Dear Leader speaking in complete word salad on how Arizona went too far. Yet, Dear Leader also celebrates that he is the one who eliminated Roe v. Wade by putting in a Christian nationalist majority on the Supreme Court. And Dear Leader said he's on tape saying he's fine with abortion being a state's rights issue. So since Dear Leader, or Trump, in case you didn't know who I was talking about, said that he supports abortion being a state's rights issue, then I have to assume that means he is fine with Arizona's complete abortion ban. They all support government owning women's bodies. They get off on it. Their white Christian nationalist movement believes that men and the government should and will have full domain over women and their bodily decisions. They try to fool people in saying that's not their goal. They really do. Right-wing talker and Fox News host Sean Hannity urged Arizona's Republican Party to repeal that 1864 law. But when Arizona Republicans refused, Hannity, of course, blamed Democrats, of course, even though Republicans are the majority in the Arizona state legislature. You see, they're running scared and they don't know what to do. You know, this reminds me of when the Alabama state Supreme Court ruled that embryos used in IVF treatments were human beings. You know, after that ruling, many on the right said that ruling went too far. Yet, when U.S. Senate Democrats introduced a bill protecting all IVF treatments, Senate Republicans blocked the bill from getting a vote. Huh. Like, I know the press said that Dear Leader neutralized the abortion debate because he said it's a states' rights issue and that he wouldn't sign a national abortion ban, but it's already being set in motion by his Supreme Court majority. They've already signaled that in the future they'll use another old law, the Comstock Act of 1873, to ban the abortion pill in the future. And maybe even other things. And while Dear Leader says he wouldn't sign such a bill, what happens if Republicans regain the Senate and trash any kind of parliamentary procedure and pass an abortion ban? You think Trump won't sign it? I mean, that's why the Senate race in Michigan is just as important, okay? Remember that. Because if there is a national abortion ban, that nullifies abortion rights here in Michigan. The very serious people in the press may say that abortion won't be a major issue this November, but you know better.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan. It's Pat Johnston.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Don't forget to visit me on X or Twitter. The handle is Left of Lansing, and vote on the weekly online poll that's located there. Special thanks to Bridge Magazine's Paula Gardner for joining us this week and providing us with some more insight on how Michigan's corporate subsidies aren't exactly doing a stellar job at creating high-paying jobs, which they promised would happen. Next week, Dr. Luke Schaefer will join me to talk about a program called RX Kids that's underway in Flint. Dr. Schaefer was the key player in helping get that program off the ground, and it's providing all pregnant mothers in Flint with no strings attached, $1,500 during their pregnancy, and $500 for each month of the baby's first year. Yeah, I think I call that a pro-life initiative, wouldn't you? Dr. Schaefer will join me next week to talk more about that. Please subscribe to the podcast and give it a 5-star review. Until next week, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.